Well, thank you. Good afternoon. I just ate not too long ago, and I'm feeling sleepy, so I hope I don't put you to sleep. I think Gus is right. We need rebates. Anybody argue with that? Anybody really want to hear about dicamba? Really? Seriously? I can just leave now and be glad to. So, unfortunately, our experience in the Mid-South, and in particular Tennessee, with dicamba the last 2 years now and going on three is akin to a bad spaghetti western. And actually, I thought this was a pretty good spaghetti western. But a lot of the ins and outs, ups and downs, you'd see in one of those movies we've certainly had over the last several years. I'm going to start off with the good. And in that, it gives us a tool that we're really starting to really need in the Mid-South. I got a graduate student, Drake Copeland. He's been out surveying pigweed in Tennessee. And it's been absolutely astounding how quickly the PPO-resistant Palmer amaranth has become well established now across the state. In his survey this last time, 83% of the population was resistant to the PPO herbicides. On top of that, the mechanisms of resistance is it's terrifying. He's been able to take samples of these plants that survive. He goes up to Pat Trandall's lab at the University of Illinois, and he's actually been able to identify the mechanisms of resistance. And heretofore, we never saw resistance to a couple of these mechanisms. They found it in common ragweed, but not in Palmer amaranth. But lo and behold, we have it in Tennessee and indeed the Mid-South. We've got Palmer amaranth with at least three resistance mechanisms to PPO herbicides. What's most concerning, though, is there were some of those that were resistant to Flexstar that we couldn't figure out there wasn't a resistance mechanism that we could identify. And in some of these locations, we're seeing other herbicides not perform like we really would have thought they would have. Even corn herbicides like Callisto, things like that. Seeing some slippage around the board. Tom Barber's in the back, but some of it's right across the river from him in Arkansas. So, is it all bad? Well, no, it's not all bad. This is actually from one of those sites where we had a confirmed PPO-resistant Palmer amaranth. And we're looking at control 21 days after treatment, and we're looking at a susceptible site. Actually, this was a site we chose that was at a vegetable production where they really don't use any herbicides. Their weed control is hand weeding, so there's no selection pressure for herbicide resistance. And we compared it to this location. And you'll see even one shot of Extendamax on 3 to 4 inch pigweed was not what you would want it to be. Flexstar was worthless. But when we sprayed Extendamax and followed it 7 days later with fumesafen, it worked. Somehow the dicamba is jacking up the resistance mechanism enough that Flexstar is effective again. So maybe some of this can still help with some of this new technology that we no longer have. The other good thing, at least from my part of the world, is cover crops. This technology, whether it's Enlist, Extend, even Liberty Link, can really make a cover crop a much more effective weed control tool than we've had in the past. Gus just got down, and the entomologists hate it for the green bridge, but I tell you, from a weed science perspective, I love these cover crops. I love terminating them as close to planting or even after planting. And you got a green bridge, you got all those bugs, it keeps y'all employed, you know, Scott and Angus, so y'all need a lot more work. But I think we're fixing to give them more work because we are seeing much better weed control. With Palmer amaranth, basically we're cutting down the population we got even fooled with by 50% before we're even doing a herbicide. This is just one shot at planting with Extendamax, Roundup Power Max, and looking at Zidua Warrant and Dual Magnum. That's 83 days after application with that cover crop. That's pretty robust. The bad, and you got to be living on a rock if you don't know the bad. It's just a massive drift we've had across the landscape in the Mid-South for 2 years, and in a few places three, but two really, really bad the last 2 years. What's driving it? Well, I think a lot of it is just a percentage, particularly of soybean. And in soybeans that are basically in Tennessee, 60% of it is Extend soybeans. This last year, and 40% were not. And I think one of the things that was a problem is when half the soybeans in the state are not tolerant, are tolerant, then the other half are in harm's way. And there's a good chance they're going to get drifted on in some form or fashion from one direction or another And unfortunately, that turned out to be the case. And then you throw cotton in on top. We're pretty much all extend cotton. The growers in Tennessee fell in love with Delta and Pineland a long time ago, and when they could, they jumped right back into them. So we got a lot of extend cotton. So we had a lot of dicamba being sprayed, and then a lot of soybeans that were in harm's way. What did that lead to? It wore out the Department of Agriculture's in a lot of states, particularly the folks in the Mid-South and the Midwest, and in the states with a lot of soybeans. It was a national issue, really, from Minnesota to Mississippi and Nebraska to Ohio. I saw a survey just the other day from the University of Nebraska of their growers, and 90% of them did not report dicamba-injured soybeans on their farms. And they've got, 93 official complaints into the Nebraska Department of Ag. But 9 out of 10 didn't report them. So the magnitude of the problem they had was a lot greater than what you even see on some of these numbers. The exception to the rule, and he's fixing to come up and walk on stage here, was the Southeast. They had a lot fewer complaints. North Carolina, South Carolina, Alabama, Georgia. Why? And I hear all kinds of reasons why. I'll let Stanley talk here a little bit. He'd have a lot better insight than I would. But I think one of the reasons clearly is no soybeans. We found they're very, very sensitive, and they're in harm's way a long time. We're planting them. We start planting them in April in Tennessee, and we quit planting, whether we need to or not, in late August. So we got a lot of soybeans in harm's way over a long period of time, and I think that's part of the problem. I think the in-person training they did was very good and certainly helped. I think environment and timing, some combination of factors. I think part of the reason maybe they just got a lot more high-value crops and are more sensitive to what's next door than we are. What I can tell you is we had vast dicamba movement like I've never seen before across the landscape. I'm standing out in a section of soybeans as far as I can see in every direction. Three different farmers, all Liberty Link, all different sprayers, and it's like it's been sprayed. I've never seen anything like I've seen the last 2 years, and I'm no stranger to dicamba. I worked with it a lot when I worked in southern Illinois. I can tell you it was bad in June, but July was the worst. It seemed like it moved further. We were spraying bigger weeds late. There's all kinds of problems with this picture right here. But it's more, you see it often because folks trying to get around as timely as possible, and they're just not very timely. We're spraying big pigweeds. There's three things that go wrong here. Number one, you're spraying big pigweeds. Tom Mueller, my colleague in Knoxville, has some data that shows when you're spraying these bigger pigweeds, you're going to be a lot more likely to see volatility after spraying those. Number two, you're spraying bigger pigweed. That's selected for resistance. And number three, you've already lost yield when you're letting it compete that long. But the big thing it hits when we're spraying this late is we are hitting beans often for the second. And I walk in the fields that were drifted on soybeans for the third time. And when you hit them multiple times, those are the ones that really are in most jeopardy of seeing significant yield loss. This is one of the fields I got called to in early June. I got called to in late June. And then we had an encore in July when I went and looked at it again. And it got hit from several different fields, I'm confident, from different directions. But the extend soybeans in his right hand, Drake's right hand, the Liberty Links are in his left. It's surprising how well those Liberty Links did yield. They were at least in the ballpark. They weren't complete wipeout, but 10 bushel off the pace, 15 bushel off the pace, it can really get in some folks' pocket. So what about the yield reports at the end of the year? We were the Garden of Eden this year in Tennessee. We're going to set records on everything. We had just unbelievable corn yields. Our soybean yields were going to be real good, if not a record. Our cotton's right there, probably near a record. But we had ideal weather for yields. And soybeans are very forgiving. I think we all know that. They can take a beating and still recover, and I think we saw that in a lot of fields. Some of the reports I've gotten, it's all anecdotal. There's no way to figure this out because it's landscape level movement of this dicamba. So it's 10%, maybe 20% off the pace. Some of these fields have been hit multiple times. The ones that were got probably not as much press were the things that weren't soybeans, and I got several calls on these. When you get tobacco hit, you're done. There is no partial credit on it. When the Philip Morris agronomist goes out, or the contractor goes out and sees that cobra hooded shaped leaf, you've lost the contract, $10,000 an acre. We had a couple of these fields, the insurance, it got their attention right away. We had the largest vineyard in the state hit. We can't be doing this anymore. If you want this technology in 2019, we cannot be drifting on these high-value crops. That's just, you can't be spraying anywhere near them, quite frankly, if you don't want to hit them. Homeowners. Some of these homeowners wore me out and wore a lot of my county agents out. Some of them are here. Jeff's over there. You get call after call, a lot of concern. Why are my hydrangeas not blooming this year? Well, dicamba got a whiff of them. But a lot of homeowner calls, trees, red buds. And folks, this year is an election year. These folks, I've seen some landscaping, thousands of dollars worth of landscaping being hit. These folks contribute to campaigns. These folks vote. This can have a big impact this next year outside of agriculture, and it is outside of agriculture now. So what are the reasons for all this off-target movement? I did a survey of the county agents in Tennessee and a bunch of the retailers, and they really centered on five different things that are really causing it. And one of the ones I thought going in was going to be tank contamination, and really it wasn't that big an issue. We did it overall a pretty good job, and that was my sense too when I walked a lot of these fields. Dicamba misapplication. It's hard to hit that label. That label has a lot of criteria in it. I was surprised we did as well as we did, being as close to the label as possible. So that wasn't as big a deal. Dicamba volatilization. The county agents really felt that was a big part of it. I do too, of it picking up and moving days after it was sprayed. And the retailers thought as much as well. Spraying into a temperature inversion. And a lot of it, I think, on this, when I did the survey, a lot of them combined these two, because I think we had some volatilization moving into temperature inversions. And then using illegal dicamba formulations. I've had some folks ask, well, which one of those numbers is right? Well, I don't know if they both can't be right. I'm confident the retailers know how much they sprayed or how much sales they lost if somebody bought it online or something. But the devil's in the detail. When was it sprayed? And my sense is, and I've walked a number of these fields, my county agents have walked a lot of these fields and report the same thing, that they were sprayed early, closer around burn down. They weren't sprayed in June and July when we're seeing a lot of this dicamba move across the landscape. There was other surveys out there. One from Illinois with the Illinois Fertilizer Chemical Association was very good, and it looked very similar to this as far as the causes. But one of the things that was very interesting in that survey, and this is the only one I'm going to show, this is from a bunch of their retailers that go out and spray. That's what they do full time. Did you see dicamba injury symptoms to non-DT soybeans even when the wind was not blowing toward the field during the time of application? And 85% of them said they did. I thought that was a very telling statistic. The other thing that was really concerning, if you drill down in that survey, most stated 50% of the non-DT soybeans near an extend field that received a dicamba application showed injury. That's a high percentage, a very high percentage. So I think there's a lot of things going on. I don't think there's just one thing going on. And volatility, I think, is definitely could be part of the issue. And there's been a lot of work on it. Tom Mueller, my colleague at Knoxville's got these puff sensors where he sets up above the ground after he goes out and sprays an acre of soybeans, and then he'll measure it for hours after application. And this is just one of his studies. He's got a bunch of them, but he usually sprays them 6 o'clock in the morning. So that 0 to 6 hours is that morning, 6 to 12 is that afternoon, and then as we go on through the day and the night the next day. And you can see Extendamax and Ingenia are less volatile than Clarity. But Extendamax and Ingenia are not zero. I want a zero. How far out do we have to go to not get a zero? I've yet to see that data. I've seen data going out 48 hours, even longer, and we still don't have a zero. Education. We are doing an unbelievable job trying to do education this year, trying to just reemphasize a lot of the best management practices. But, folks, we did a lot of education last year. In Tennessee, 5,523 applicators took an hour in-person dicamba stewardship training, or they took a 30-minute stewardship module, which really concentrated on it. We posted 13 blogs on stewardship management that were accessed 3,600 times. We did 16 in-season YouTube videos that were viewed over 13,000 times. Monsanto and BASF did a lot of training. And yet in Tennessee, we had 400,000 acres of soybeans get injured with dicamba, and that's just soybeans. Just not good. In extension, this time of year, we got to fill out our forms. Scott's been doing it here. He's actually a little tardier than I am, which is saying something, this year. And they're always wanting impact, right, Scott? Fortunately, they don't ask me if it's positive impact or negative impact. I would like that to be zero and be a positive impact, but it clearly is not right now. Here's the thing. If you look at 17, that was hard to follow that label. 18 is going to be tougher. So I just put out, this is 2018, this is all the EPA former labels, the new label additions, what the Tennessee Department of Ag is tacking on there. There's only 21 things you're going to have to do. It's daunting. And a lot of those things, if you stray just a little bit, you're very vulnerable to drifting on a neighbor. It's going to be tough, to say the least. Here's the thing. One can follow that label to the letter, all 21 of those things, and still get drift because I don't have a zero yet. And I think that's part of the mix. Most of my colleagues do too. That's the great debate right now going on in this industry. There's some evidence that dicamba can stick to dust and move. I think that's in the mix too in some places. Fine spray particles, I'm sure they're in the mix as well, especially if we're using the wrong nozzles. I don't think we did a lot of that in Tennessee because BASF gave out a pile of nozzles for free, but I'm still a little sure we're some old ones. And dicamba can move with runoff water, and I've seen that in the last couple of years in a number of fields. So it can move a number of different ways, even if you follow the label. To me, and I'm going to go with Stanley here, he's going to have a more positive note than I'm going to have, but there's a good chance this doesn't end well in 18. Start off, I think, in the Mid-South, it's probably going to be better off. Just because in Arkansas, you're going to have a limited or no use in season. In Missouri, Mississippi, and Tennessee, we're going to be 80% extend soybeans. Most of my growers will not take another thumping. They're just going to go ahead and plant them. So there's going to be less soybeans in harm's way in the Mid-South. My concern is, and I'm talking to some growers here recently, even less concern for BMPs. They're like, well, everybody's going to be planting extend soybeans next year. Why do I even have to care? We got a lot of other plants in the horizon. Part of it is we're still going to have a few acres of non-DT soybeans. There's folks not going to go to the new technology, and those things will be in harm's way. But the homeowners, the vineyards, the tobacco, the truck patches, these things in an election year in particular, I think, can really come forward and cause us a lot of trouble if we're wanting to see this technology with a label in 2019. But to me, it's not the folks in this room. It's going to be the Midwest. Next year, half the soybeans in the Midwest, and I just took Illinois and Iowa as an example, there's 22 million acres of soybeans in those two states. This last year, 10 to 20% of those acres were extend. This next year, 11 million acres of those are going to be extend, and when you have every other field in harm's way on some windy, open fields, I'm from Illinois, I've seen it, I think there's a high probability we're going to see a lot of injury in those states. And I think that's going to be one of the things the EPA takes into account when they decide whether to give us another label after this year. And I thought Rick Kegwin just year ago this year, I thought he made it very plain in a talk he gave that they're going to be looking at this. And if it doesn't improve, the label goes away. And I've been putting this up as my take-home warning in all our training. We've got to be serious about trying to follow these best management practices to the letter, or we won't have this technology going forward. I'd like to say I'm more positive. Scott says I just pull the air right out of the room, and then he comes in and, yeah, shoot yourself in the head. But that's I don't know how else you color it. That's the way I see it, so. I don't know if we have time for questions. I probably
Several minutes for questions.
Okay. Right now. I should have used more slides. Yeah. Yes, sir. Good question. Question is there a correlation between no-till and volatility? There is so much work going on right now looking at a bunch of different factors. I don't think until this year we knew that you'd see more volatility on grown green plants than you would if you did bare sand, ground. Tom Mueller had some data where he sprayed, I think it was Extendamax, he sprayed it on tilled ground, he sprayed it on what would be no-till, burned down with gramoxone, dead brown plants, and then he sprayed it on foot-tall green pigweed. And he got an order of magnitude more volatility from going spraying dirt to spraying burnt down to spraying green plants. The green plants were absolutely the worst. You saw more volatility off that than you did off a no-till. And off the soil, you saw the least, is kind of how it's still. So the answer to your question is yes. I think that what little data is out there would suggest there is. Okay, nobody's committed suicide. That's good. Yeah. Okay, question was, drift on from dicamba onto non-dicamba cotton. I did get some calls on those. Cotton is remarkably tolerant to it, so they seem to shake it off and not be a big deal, though you see some of these Enlist cotton trials out there, and they're off the pace in some places, and you wonder if maybe that didn't take off a little bit of the top end, but there's no data. It's like all this. It's impossible to put your finger on that. I will say one thing, at least in Tennessee with Enlist, we had 26,000 acres of Enlist cotton in Tennessee, and it was remarkably quiet. I got hardly any calls on it moving. We had a few instances, but nothing like we did with dicamba the year before when it was probably sprayed on about the similar amount of acres. So the first year out of the gate, it looked very good for staying put. And it was the same growers, same sprayers, same nozzles, and they did a better job keeping it on the field. So I am taking everything with a grain of salt. I'd like to see, because I think part of this we're seeing with dicamba is scale. I don't think it'd be as big a problem if we were spraying smaller acres, but I think when we start ramping up the scale, it is more likely to see problems. And that might be the same case with Enlist. I hope not. That's a real good point. And that was something going into this up until this last year. We had no data on. Ken, you were with Vesicol. You started dicamba, right? So, I mean, we were thinking one-time drift event. None of us were thinking these multiple drift events that you know, we're seeing. And I don't know what that does to cotton. That's another open question. We got a lot of research to do. Okay, thank you all.
Appreciate it so much. Thanks. They're long.